Welcome to The Riff, where writer and investor Bern Hobart and I discuss the major inflection points caused by technological change. Our weekly conversation covers the obvious and not so obvious ways in which markets and businesses will adapt as a result. Let's jump right in.
Hey, Bern, excited to get to a few different topics. How about let's start with this this thing you wrote about where the companies spying on each other.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is it's a fun topic. I think it's a kind of topic where you know it has to happen and that the people who are best at it are people you've never heard of because they're the ones who've successfully spied on competitors and gotten away with it. And those competitors are gone now. Like there aren't that many cases where a company has been actually just completely obliterated because their secrets got out. Although there is this claim that Nortel had a really big hack at one point and they were downhill forever since then. And the Huawei was able to offer very similar products to theirs, but much more cheaply because its R&D expenses were mysteriously low. Like that, I am not sure how true that is, but it is true that, you know, corporate espionage happens at various levels. But I think the level that is benign is just companies keeping an eye on what their competitors are doing. And that could be things like scraping competitors' websites to figure out what their prices are, but it can also get to more elaborate stuff. So there was this case that it's been widely publicized before and got back into the news cycle because there were some internal memos that got released in a legal filing about this. But Facebook, they were worried for a while about competitors and about rapidly growing competing social media apps. And so one of the things that they did was they bought this company called Onavo that did a mobile VPN. And Onavo basically gave Facebook a panel of users where they could see a lot of the things that these people were doing on what sites they were visiting and what apps they were using. But in many cases, apps would encrypt a lot of their traffic. So Facebook could not actually see what they were doing within the apps, but was very curious about that, especially for Snap. So they ended up being able to break the encryption and they were able to decrypt the traffic on the device, figure out what people were doing in the app, then re-encrypt it, and send it back to Snap. So Snapchat had no idea that they were doing this, but Facebook was able to see not just people are spending a lot of time on Snapchat, but here are the specific things that people really like doing. And this is the stuff that you do really care about. That if you're running a company, you have competitors, one of your competitors is growing, your first question is why. It is, and this gets to something I wrote about a couple of weeks ago, that there's a high opportunity cost for features when a company is successful. Like people will sometimes they'll complain that some product is basically what it was 10 years ago. And one reason for that is just if you've been using it for 10 years, it must have been really good when you started using it. And it's still good enough that you haven't actually quit. Like you don't complain about the things you don't use. You just don't use them. But the other piece is that as the product gets better and as it starts printing more money, it becomes extremely expensive to do anything else with it. So Facebook is actually very admirable in this respect, that when they decided that short video was a big deal, and before that, when they decided that stories were a big deal, they just gave up screen real estate to that feature and basically gave enough screen real estate that they engineered this behavioral change in their users, where users who were posting stories to Snapchat started doing stories in Instagram and Facebook instead. That users who weren't really familiar with stories, that was their first exposure to it. They decided it was a pretty good product. And for them, it's just been synonymous with Facebook and Instagram from the beginning. But initially, that was a headwind. That was something they're doing instead of showing the content people already like, and instead of showing ads against that content. Typically, when they launch a new feature like that, the ad load starts out at zero and they move it up very cautiously because they want the habit to form before they start monetizing it. But yeah, when a company when their run rate is $100 billion a year or plus, it gets really expensive to say we're giving up X percent of our traffic. Like when you're quoting it in percentage points, you're quoting it in billions of dollars for Facebook. They did that, and Stories was a headwind for a while and then reached monetization parity pretty much. And then they stopped talking about the monetization impact as much. And then Reels, same kind of story. But a lot of this, it's faster to do it if you know exactly what your competitor, what people are doing in your competitor's apps. But that's also hard to figure out. And one thing you could do if you didn't want to spy on your competitors too directly, you could say, okay, we're going to accept that sometimes some alternative product is going to grow. We will just see if that happens, see if it gets to the point where it's too big to ignore, and we'll be ready to launch these competing features, but we won't actually launch them right away because we just don't know. But the problem with that is that if you have a competitor who's growing 20% week over week, they're more than doubling in size every month. So it becomes, you know, very big, very fast. And the bigger they get, the more they are synonymous with whatever that new engagement mode is. And so if And I think this is like the broad meta thesis. We can call them meta now. The broad meta thesis is that people want to interact with one another online. As people spend more of their time online, they will interact more online, but that we haven't figured out all the ways that they do that just yet. And they have the second part of the thesis is, okay, Meta's full of really smart people. They have a lot of great product people, a lot of great engineers. They spend a lot of time thinking about this problem, but they just aren't going to make the bet that every new way of interacting online gets invented at Meta. It's just not going to happen. So they do copy other features, but then there's a third thing, which is if you do let your growth be defined by just a competitor is showing really good metrics in the aggregate, you don't know exactly what's driving those. It could be a flash in the pan. It could be something where it was a cool feature for a while. It was a fun gimmick, but people use it for a month and they quit. Now, if they use it for a month and in that month, at the beginning of that month, they invite five of their friends, you can have this amazing growth curve where the population is overwhelmingly people who are early adopters who are also sharing the app, and not much of that population is people who are later in their life in that cohort and are starting to get less engaged. But if you actually have really granular usage data, you can start to see that. So you can see, for example, that Be Real is still growing, but the users who've been around, like anyone who's been around for 3 months, they stop responding to the push notification quite so aggressively. And then you kind of model that out and you say, okay, they're actually going to flatten out at whatever, 20 million daily actives, 30 million daily actives, and then they'll start to decline. And once they start declining, they can't replace that growth. And so they go away. So the more you know about exactly what people are doing within those sites, the more you can figure out what not to copy as well as what to copy. And again, given the opportunity cost, it pretty much like saves a company like Meta billions of dollars to not try to chase Be Real and to decide that this is actually not the main new mode of interaction. I think they did something a little bit similar to Be Real. They didn't really push it that hard. They tested it a little bit, but it wasn't the same kind of investment that they made with Reels and Stories. It looks really bad. It looks really bad to say this company installs this product that users don't think of as spyware, but it's basically spyware. And it's tracking everything they do. It's tracking literally the disappearing messages they sent to their friends. They don't disappear everywhere. There's someone who's logging all that stuff. But that, in another sense, so they did ask people to opt into that. It wasn't that anyone didn't know what it was. It was that people were opting into something that, like, I personally would not opt into, but some people would. And it's also not that different from just running a focus group. So if Facebook had periodically gotten together, 30 active Snapchat users and put them in a room, gave them snacks and said, okay, just like spend this time, like show us how you use Snapchat, start messaging with each other, show us what's cool about this, tell us what you like about it. Like that, I don't think anyone would say that that's actually some really sinister thing, even though it's human intelligence rather than signals intelligence. And usually the human stuff gets a little bit more, it can lead to more qualms in other contexts, but it is pretty expensive to do that. And that you get a less representative sample if you have a focus group and, people act a little bit different. Like even if they know they're being spied on in the back of their head, they act a little bit differently if they can literally see the spy watching them right there. So, the PR blowback was kind of inevitable. And my guess is that they probably don't do things quite that aggressive anymore. I think they've reached the point where it's not even that you want to do that kind of thing, but be even more discreet about it and have fewer people CC'd on emails, because emails are still discoverable. And if it's clear that you're keeping secrets, if you have an email, from Mark Zuckerberg saying, by the way, don't tell anyone in the company that we're doing this, but here's what we need to do right now, that's actually much more exciting. At that point, you might as well just tweet that email out, make sure you tag every attorney general you can think of, make sure everybody knows, because it's going to be in the news cycle one of these days. So my guess is they don't do that. It's one of those fun things companies used to be able to do that they can't do anymore. And that's good. Like, you sort of want companies, like individuals, that they have this childhood and, young adulthood is when they start they're like capable enough to do things, but their judgment is still somewhat impaired. And so they're capable of doing really entertainingly stupid things. And then at some point they grow out of it and they stop. And some of those things are just objectively stupid. There's no point to them. But some of them are like high risk, high reward. And it's good to get that out of your system and see what the possibility space is, so that when you have other cases where you can do the high risk, high reward thing, where the risk is not legal risk, it's not future ethical qualms risk, it's not antitrust risk, it's just business risk. Things like betting really big on AI or trying to build the metaverse or trying to build self-driving cars. It's good for people who have taken other risks at small scale earlier in their life. It's good for institutions that used to take those risks to just have a sense of what the payoff is, have a sense of what the ups and downs are. Like, you did something really clever. It worked really well. Uh-oh, there's this horrible thing that happened as a consequence, and now you have to deal with that. And then you hopefully exit that, you know, wiser and tamer. Maybe you pay some fines and you don't do quite that same thing next time. But yeah, the general story of corporate espionage is just, it's a fun story. It's one of those intrinsically adversarial games. You have asymmetric information. You also, the whole point is to collapse one form of asymmetric information, which is your competitors know a lot more about their metrics and their unit economics than you do. But you're actually adding a new dimension of asymmetric information, which is no one knows how much the other side knows. There was a fun case of this a couple years back where there was this company that their consumer-facing product was, we are an extension, you tie us to your Gmail, and we will tell you things like, if you bought something and it got discounted the next day, you can actually ask for a refund on some sites and we'll just automate that. Or if there's a shipping delay, like, we'll scrape your inbox, look at all of your tracking notifications, we'll tell you what's coming today, what's delayed, etc. Nice usable stuff. And, you know, as a consequence of that, that product has to read someone's inbox. And what the company was doing to monetize this wonderful free product was they were selling the data. They were anonymizing it and selling it to data providers. Some of those were financial institutions and, you know, financial researchers who wanted to know things like, what do unit economics, like, what does retention look like for Grubhub versus Uber Eats versus DoorDash? How does that vary by geography? Like, are there cities where different companies dominate or don't dominate? You can learn a lot of really interesting stuff from that. But it was also sold to companies in the industry. So, like, Uber was buying this data. And if they have a bunch of purchase data that they bought from a third party and they can see all of someone's transactions and that create an email receipt, but they also have their own internal data, so they can see things like who bought an Uber on what date, then they can actually de-anonymize people. And if they de-anonymize people, they could do very, very targeted offers where if they have a loyal Uber customer, that customer tries Lyft once, they want to make sure that there is never a case where, you know, there's never a case where Lyft is a better deal than Uber for that person until they have dropped the Lyft habit and deleted the Lyft app. So that kind of thing does get creepy, because, like, when investors are looking at the data, they only care about the aggregated data. Like, anyone who is interesting enough to be interesting is also just an outlier who should not be counted. They're probably throwing off your calculations of panel size or something. So you just throw out anything interesting without giving it a second thought. But on the marketing side, particularly at a company like Uber, which was very willing to lean into regulatory risk, that was very willing to do things that other people thought crossed an ethical line, they were more willing to do things like that. And I don't know for sure if that is exactly what they were doing and why they got caught when this story came out, but that kind of thing does make people a lot more nervous for understandable reasons. And again, like, no one who is doing this, like, cares about specifically who they're targeting with this kind of super targeted offer, but they are targeting very individual people based on their personal spending behavior. And it's based on spending behavior that these people don't realize is leaking out to third parties. So it does get tricky, but I think it's unavoidable that people who run companies are very, very curious about what their competitors are doing. There is this argument that you shouldn't do that, that, you know, nobody has been killed by competitors. Startups only die because they make something people don't want or make something that you can't sell to people at a price that recoups your cost. That is true, but if you believe that early on, it's like the best advice possible is if you're starting something new, do not think about your competitors. It is totally pointless. Like, if they knew what they were doing, why would you be starting a company in the first place? But as a company grows, it can definitely hit this local maximum where they are obsessed with their customers, but their customers are one limited subset of the market. And the better they get at serving those customers' needs, the worse they get at serving everybody else's needs. And you can ask, well, how do I find the global maximum, or how do I find a better local maximum? And the global maximum is hard to find, but you can look at your competitors and treat every one of them as being at a different local maximum than yours. And the better you understand why they're there, how they got there, and what could keep them, you know, what could dislodge them from that position, the more likely you are to actually build a better product. So, like, if you're designing an optimal world and you start with a blank slate, you want the best companies to also be the most aggressive with this kind of corporate espionage. You want them to know what lucky decision a more mediocre company made so that they can do the same thing but better and everyone wins. But you also definitely want to have some constraints on that, because it does involve trading lots of people's data around. And even though basically everyone in these stories did get presented with a terms and conditions page, and they did scroll through it and click, yes, I've read it. Yes, I agree. You can do exactly what you said you're going to do. Nobody read it. Nobody reads those. So everyone is opting into things that they don't entirely understand. And that does give someone a responsibility. If you know that people are making an ill-considered decision, it is an obligation on your part to actually act as if they had made a well-considered decision and do the kinds of things that they would expect you to do.
We'll get back to the conversation in a moment after a word from our sponsors. Hey everyone, Eric here. At Turpentine, we're building the first media outlet for tech people by tech people. We're the network behind the show you're listening to right now. We have a slate of hit shows across a range of topics and industries, from our AI and investing cluster of podcasts to shows that drive the conversation in tech with the most interesting thinkers, founders, investors, and influencers, like Econ 102 with Noah Smith. We're launching new shows every week, and we're looking for industry-leading sponsors. If you think that might be you and your company, email me at ericaturpentine.co. That's E-R-I-K at turpentine.co, and let's partner together.
That is well said. I want to transition to another topic you wrote about, which is outsourcing and how that sort of coincided with the East Asian boom.
Yeah. So I've been obsessed with the East Asian boom for a long time. Some of these, like Japan and South Korea, were some of the poorest places in the world after World War II. Now they are at parity with other developed countries. In some ways, their economies are weaker, but in some ways, their economies are a lot stronger. And there's that question of how they got there. And this is very well-trod territory. A lot of people have talked about this, that it's basically, I think the book to read is How Asia Works, and goes through this process of basically, you break up large agricultural estates, and your initial source of potential energy is just more farmers actually own the output that they produce, and they care a lot more about efficiency, and labor is incredibly cheap in very poor economies. So they work really hard, and if they grow 10 or 20% more fruits and vegetables, but they were at subsistence, then you actually had just this order of magnitude increase in disposable incomes relative to that subsistence, because they're mostly putting in calories to grow food and then using those calories and then eating the calories they've produced. And if you can create some kind of surplus there, there's a little bit of money to invest, and it can often be invested in industries that are very low value added, very labor intensive. Clothes are the classic one. Toys are not as big an industry, but they were part of the economic development path for Japan. And then when Japan got too expensive, it was Hong Kong. And then when Hong Kong got too expensive, it was China. And these industries they have been chased around that part of the world as labor costs get too expensive. But I thought there was this interesting analogy between that and how some companies operate, where early on, especially if they're doing something really new, there are just a lot of problems that they have to solve themselves because no one else has solved that problem. Early Google, they had to figure out how to run a big, cheap data center using commodity hardware and how to build lots of distributed systems. Now, a lot of that stuff, like Google's built a bunch of internal tools such that they don't really need to use external vendors for a lot of that. But if you're doing something like that today, you don't have to figure out who sells the cheapest hard drives and go shopping and start screwing things together and putting things on racks and things. Like, you just go to AWS and buy this stuff. As ecosystems develop, they tend to have more and more outsourcing and more specialization. But one of the things I realized is that at least in manufacturing, that increase in outsourcing and specialization was just the mirror image of the East Asian development model, that as the US is getting priced out of lower value added industries, other countries are developing their way into being able to service those industries. So it may be the case that, at least in manufacturing, that story of companies start out kind of full stack, they learn to outsource the low value added stuff, they focus on the high value added stuff, that is historically contingent on having a part of the world to which you can outsource a lot of stuff. And as the world maybe retreats a little bit from globalization, and as more countries decide that they are going to try to have some industries where they don't compete just on price, but they compete on quality, or they have a homegrown national champion and they restrict outside, they restrict global companies from competing with that national champion, that model just doesn't apply as much. And what I think you end up with is a world where the industrial companies do have lower margins because they're forced to do more lower margin stuff themselves. Sometimes it's because there just isn't a big gain from outsourcing. In other cases, it's because they actually worry about this strategic dependence. It is still the case that a lot of intermediate goods in manufactured products, they pass through the Chinese supply chain at some point. And for some of those, it's totally fine, very unlikely for there to be a big political risk there. But in other cases, you really want to have a second option and you want it to be somewhere in a different part of the world from that. So that necessarily compresses margins a bit. It lowers returns on equity, but it also means that it creates a more resilient industrial ecosystem, both at the company level and at the country level, where the US is just really dependent on trade partners for certain things. There are certain things we just can't replicate. And as long as we're happy with that relationship, that's great. But if that relationship is at risk, the US is in a much worse negotiating position than its trade counterparties. And it's never good for the negotiation to start from that standpoint. Now, in tech, it's interesting to speculate on whether the general trend towards quasi-outsourcing in the form of just using more external SaaS products and using more external dev tools and things, like, does that continue indefinitely? Are there cases where companies can insource a little bit profitably? And there are anecdotes about companies that were cloud-based and switched to on-prem, but often in that case, it's because the cloud is really good when you don't know what demand will look like and you want to be able to flexibly respond to things. Like, you want to make sure that your site does not even hiccup if usage just goes up 10x overnight. But once you have a more mature business, you're paying a lot for optionality and you don't actually need the optionality. So at that point, it can start to make sense. You know, 37signals famously did this. There have been other companies that have talked about this, you know, decloudifying some of the stuff they do. I think it is a negative sign for growth, but not every company should be designed to just grow forever and ever. So in some cases, it's actually a positive sign that the company has reached, you know, per the previous discussion, the company has reached this comfortable middle age. It kind of knows who it is and what it's supposed to be doing. And once it knows that, it can plan more effectively and can figure out if it's better to just buy the drives themselves or if it still makes sense to outsource that to somebody else who has their own margins to think about and their own different economic structure.
Let's go deeper on this point. You wrote a capital gains piece about how companies age gracefully. What more is there to share there as it relates to, you know, we're just talking about the middle age of companies or companies aging?
Yeah, like, a company is partly this exploration process of asking, like, you know, a company, there's one theory that it's a bundle of contracts and one theory that it's like, it's a big happy family and, you know, those families end up very dysfunctional. But one way to think about it is that a company is this exploration process of, if we gather together a set of people who are working full-time together, and if we gather together some physical assets and we start accumulating some relationships, like, what is the economically optimal way to deploy that bundle of resources? And the bundle is like a lot of other economic bundles. It's creating some value through the complementarity of these different things and through the fact that this group of people who've been working together for a while, they probably work together better than if you scattered them to the winds. Just a company, by the fact that it exists and that people have experience and that their customers know who they are and their supplier, they have relationships with their suppliers too. Like, it's worth more than the sum of its parts. It should be worth more than book value. And companies typically try to retain earnings when they're profitable and then reinvest those earnings, at least some share of those earnings, back in the business to grow it. And at some point, they just run out of reinvestment opportunities, or at least they run out of directly relevant reinvestment opportunities. And at that point, one thing they can do is figure out, what is the adjacent thing we could be building? What is the next thing to add to this? What thing would our customers like that is not being done very well by existing providers, or where our cost structure means we could provide this more cheaply than our competitors could? But in some cases, you can brainstorm and brainstorm and just not come up with anything. And at that point, you are like, the optimal thing to do is pay a big dividend or buy back stock or otherwise just return capital to shareholders. And it's very rare for a company to exist on this knife's edge where they have exactly enough assets to serve this business and they shouldn't expand their assets, but they also don't need to shrink. Typically, they're either growing at some pace or shrinking at some pace. And that shrinking process can be done in a, you know, less, more or less graceful way, but it's typically that they have met some need in the market, and there can be, in some cases, if they're selling like a durable good, there could be this deployment phase where everyone realizes they need one and they buy one. But then you have this replacement phase where everyone who needed one bought one, and now the next buyer is buying when their previous version broke. And so you very rapidly downshift in the number of units you produce because you didn't need to do that deployment anymore. And this happens in pretty much any durables industry. You can see this with car sales, for example. Like, they get very, very high when a country starts actually building roads and starts becoming a car-centric country. And then at some point it levels off, and often the peak is at some point in the past, because once you've gotten to the point where 80% of households have a car or something, the only way to keep growing at the same pace from there is for households to have two cars. And then you need like a second, you know, cultural transition to a, you know, suburbia maxing US style approach to laying out cities and to just people's relationships to vehicles. And it becomes less and less affordable. Whereas that build out phase, like, that is often, people can often afford to do that in developing countries. They're typically buying smaller, cheaper vehicles, but then, you know, slowly upgrading. So it is kind of a gentle cycle, and it can work out pretty well. But I think, like, looking at the kind of late stage where a company has reached the point where they can't profitably reinvest all the money that they make, one of the places where they can sometimes deploy money is to look at all of the things that they buy from external vendors and all of the customers who are not an end user, but are some intermediary customer. And they can ask, like, is this relationship adding maximum value? And is this actually the right way to set things up? Or is there something we should potentially bring in-house? So Apple's been doing this with some of the harder to design, harder to build components of hardware, like the chips. They've been bringing a lot more of that in-house over time, and it's served them really well. But Apple is also this special case. Like, Apple is actually a wonderful example of many truths about business where they illustrate it well because they do it better than just about anybody else. And one of those is that if you have this really, really integrated product where you have hardware that's very compatible with the software, and where your software is also allowing different pieces of hardware to talk to one another, so someone is always, they're always close to the purchase point in some upgrade cycle for one of their Apple products. Like, if they just bought a new MacBook, so they don't need a new computer for a while, well, their Apple Watch is now showing its age, so maybe they will upgrade that one next. In a setup like that, Apple can start saying that we were paying this big royalty to implicit royalty on Apple sales to IBM with the PowerPC, and then to Intel. Who really deserves that royalty on sales? And by the way, is there something that wouldn't be on the Intel roadmap because they have to sell their chips widely, but that could be on the Apple specific roadmap, and that could potentially make the Apple devices perform better than any competitor can handle? And that's something that they did at small scale for a while, and at what seems to be growing scale. And you see this with some of the cloud companies doing their, like, designing special purpose chips where they see what the workloads are, they see what the constraints are, what the hardware constraints are on some of their things their customers want to do. They can look at what kinds of things they want to do. It's pretty clear that Google, in some ways, made some avoidable mistakes in AI, but they did realize that there would be just a whole lot of inference in the future, and that was hardware constrained, and that if that is the specific thing you're designing chips for, you do design something a little bit different from a more general purpose product. They also did some of that kind of insourcing where they figured out, part of what they're doing is trying to figure out, is this something where you can buy it from any of 10 people, or you can buy it from just one person? And if the answer is you can buy it from just one person, then you are always in this struggle where you don't want to just be, like, they want you to just be a slightly value-added reseller of the thing they make. And then you want them to be a slightly value-added provider of some commodity that gets marked up massively once it gets sold to the right branded company that has the right distribution, et cetera, that can really, really sell and make it worth something. So everyone is in this struggle to commoditize whoever's next to them in the supply chain. And one way to keep that from happening to you is you build the product yourself and just snap one of the links in that supply chain.
Awesome. You also wrote about a related topic, or in terms of how we think about employment. You talked about this company PubMatic, which is increasing their employee base because of AI, which is counter to what, yes, you know, people are worried about. So talk about that.
Yes. Hashtag narrative violations. It's not a huge company, but it will. That is what makes sense, that if there is some technology that improves worker productivity, In some places where demand is just pretty much capped, you do expect that to actually destroy jobs. That we farmers can produce a lot more calories per hour than they could 500 years ago, but we can't as much as we try, we can't actually increase our calorie consumption quite fast enough to outpace them. So yeah, we end up with fewer farmers. But in fields where where growth at one company can actually generate growth in another company, you can have cases where there's just indefinite demand for some categories of products. And ad tech seems to be one of those spaces where if there are actually better tools for monetizing a given piece of content, then people produce more content, and then that content creates a larger surface area for collecting targeting data. And once you've got more targeting data, it makes sense to invest more in ads, and then the cycle continues and continues and continues. Software engineering is one of those cases where it creates a lot more demand for software engineers. It's like lawyers. Like the way to double the number of lawyers that a society needs is just increase it 50%, and suddenly it's much easier to sue people, and also the contracts are a lot longer and more detailed, and there are more things where it actually makes sense to hammer things out in a contract, and so you need even more lawyers to adjust for that. The word processor, it did automate away some of the things that lawyers did, but it was a significant increase in demand for lawyers overall. Same thing with Excel and finance people, where the fact that you didn't have to spend hours a day just cranking on a mechanical calculator to run a discounted cash flow analysis, if you could just do that almost instantly with a pocket calculator, it just meant that there were a lot more things where it made sense to figure out what the net present value of the asset was and then start trading it with somebody else. And finance, like media, is this very generative business where once you have a lot of liquidity in one thing, then you end up creating demand for similar liquidity in adjacent things, and people can just keep on coming up with new permutations of the same thing and keep getting more and more targeted offerings for more and more specific customers with more and more specified needs. So it did, I had been curious, I think it's an interesting open question to ask, like, where are the companies that have literally 10x productivity through AI-based coding tools? Like I have felt the increase in productivity when I do little projects. ChatGPT makes it really fast. Mutable makes it really fast. These things really help. But I haven't really seen the case where there is some company that is just doing astounding things with a tiny footprint of engineers, and it's because of AI. But this is a promising sign. If there's, and I think they quoted some stat that their people are like 20% more efficient, which, you know, if you take this totally zero-sum view, you say, well, if they're 20% more efficient, then 1/6 of them will get fired. But it turns out, no, when they're 20% more efficient, suddenly there is a project for which on the efficiency numbers of 2 years ago, it didn't quite justify hiring another engineer to build it. But now that engineer produces 20% more, it's suddenly just above that threshold and it's worth doing. So it was a very promising story, and we'll still have to see how it shakes out. And the typical thing with technologies is that on average, historically, they do generate more jobs, but the more you think about the job in reference to the way that technology affects a specific job, the more you want to worry that the job goes away. But if there is enough demand for whatever that job can produce, then it typically moves in the other direction. That, you know, assembly lines, there were a lot more people working in manufacturing after the development of the assembly line than before, because there were just a lot more things that were worth mass producing. And I think it'll be interesting to see, you know, within companies, which roles tend to get automated away, which roles evolve in a different direction. I do think that a lot of people who write code for a living should basically think of themselves as having gotten this invisible promotion to either like an engineering manager whose direct reports all happen to be AI agents, or like a software architect who is, again, like once they have really nailed what this thing should do and how it should function, they can actually delegate a lot of the implementation details to their junior, who can, you know, can work infinite hours, but also sometimes makes dumb mistakes. So in some ways, like, yeah, everyone's been promoted to a half IC, half manager role if their job is all an individual contributor and the output of that job is Git commits.
It is interesting. We had this podcast with Noah Smith and our AI host, Nathan LeBenz, and Noah Smith has the hypothesis that even in a world where AI can do everything better than humans, because of comparative advantage, there will always be things for humans to do that it's not worth the AI's time to do, even despite the fact that, you know, AIs can clone themselves a lot easier than humans can. And what I didn't understand is, like, but wouldn't wages be compressed? That, like, wouldn't that be just be like, I'm not sure how comforting.
Well, I think wages would be compressed on a relative basis, but not necessarily on an absolute basis. So if there's a world where the AIs can all work much more effectively than humans can, that's just that, like, they are working more effectively. They're doing things, they're creating things in the world that are valuable. So that is a richer world. There is a distribution question, but there are these, people sketch out these scenarios of only the wealthy asset owners will have any any wealth, any benefit from any economic benefit from this new AI future. And that we'll basically live in a world where everyone who owned NVIDIA call options is just, unimaginably wealthy, and everyone else is just grindingly poor. But that's also just not a very politically sustainable world. And even people who are really just out for their own benefit, they tend not to want to engineer a world that is like Brazil or South Africa, where like you hire private, if you're sufficiently rich, like if you're rich enough to buy a nice house, you want to buy private security along with that house, or it's not going to be yours anymore, or something bad will happen. So you kind of don't want that extremely polarized, neo-Spartan world where there is an elite and they spend literally all of their time thinking about the vast majority of people who want them dead. And this is something that I think Sam Altman has had some foresight on, where WorldCoin is pretty good infrastructure for UBI. So all you need is just trillions and trillions of dollars, and you can actually, it's good infrastructure for distributing it, making sure that you're sending it to people who actually exist. And then you just need to solve the trillions of dollars problem. But it looks like he was working on that a little bit earlier, and that OpenAI or that WorldCoin was this, not an afterthought, but was part of that broader constellation of projects. So I don't know. The people have been talking about the singularity for a long time, and the important thing to remember with the singularity is that the abstraction that matters is, when growth reaches a sufficiently high pace, you just don't have good mental models for what that looks like. Like, that's what the singularity is. It's the point at which specific forecasts simply don't make much sense, because you have no idea what constraints apply when, GDP per capita is $1 million a year, but income inequality is more extreme than it's ever been. No one knows what that looks like. You can tell science fiction stories about it, positive or negative, but we don't really know. So I do tend to think that we will manage that transition about as gracefully as previous economic transitions, which is to say, there will be all kinds of dumb policy mistakes, and there will be all kinds of the wrong people getting rich and all kinds of bad incentives. But if each year GDP is relentlessly grinding higher, that tends to be net good. And you want to be, at a minimum, descended from people who lived at a time like that, even if you don't want to be one of those people. And so, like, we can look at the second industrial revolution. That's really when productivity growth started increasing in a measurable way. And some of it was, at least for the US economy, I'm less familiar with other countries, but for the US economy, a lot of it early on was actually less that productivity in the total factor productivity sense was going up, and more that output per hour was going up, because the US produced enough surplus income to reinvest a lot in infrastructure and manufacturing, and that the accumulation of that investment did start to produce high returns for everyone and started reducing the real cost of many goods. So reduced the real cost of transportation, made it faster and cheaper to get from, say, New York to Chicago. Like, you didn't have to, figure out your horse logistics and figure out where you're going to buy food or whatever. You could just get on a train and wait and then get there. It was a time when people were prospering relatively in material terms. It was also a time of just extreme income inequality, of a lot of political dysfunction. So that dividend did not trickle down to the average steel worker or railroad worker. They went from a bad job on a farm to a slightly less bad, but still extremely unpleasant job in a steel mill or working on a railroad. But their kids and grandkids live in this world where someone did the very sweaty and sometimes fatal work of actually building all of this stuff. And we have it. The US still has amazing freight rail infrastructure, and freight, like, that is in a modern country, especially a country with a lot of land and with a population that is not just all hugging the coast. You actually do want that. You want, like, you want rail for a lot of your long distance freight stuff, because it can't just travel on ships if it's going to, a city in the middle of a large landmass. And then for actually moving people from one place to another, aircraft are probably a better deal, like a lot faster than trains. And in the US, I believe substantially cheaper, and air travel has been getting much cheaper in real terms over time. So it does seem to be a business that has some economies of scale that and because it's a sufficiently competitive business, a lot of those economies of scale do actually accrue to consumers.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Let's segue into something you wrote about, algorithmic collusion. Why don't you unpack that?
Yeah. So algorithmic collusion, it's a fun topic. There was a spate of pieces about this a couple of years ago, because there's this software product called YieldStar, I think, and landlords use it to figure out rents. And there's, you know, if you look at that just on its own, unless you are part of Kill All the Landlords Twitter, you think this is probably fine. Like, this business, if it's a small mom and pop business, they probably don't have incredibly sophisticated demand forecasting tools and things. They're probably leaving some money on the table. And if there's some software product that can help them figure out what better pricing looks like, then that's good. And there is, you know, people worry about just like this better pricing stuff is going to mean that rents go up for everybody and landlords make all the money and no one can afford a house, which, you know, if no one can afford a house or no one can afford somewhere to live, then rents go down because vacancies go up. But even stipulating that, okay, there could just be this sudden ratchet up of rent and we all have to spend less on other stuff and the money gets redistributed to landlords. Like, it would be weird to like the flip side of that argument is saying that poor revenue management on the part of non-institutional landlords, like this load-bearing feature of the economy. And we absolutely need our landlords to do an unusually bad job compared to other industries at figuring out pricing, or we're all just screwed. And I don't really think that is all that true. But there does become a complicating factor when most or all of the landlords in some region are using the same software and they are all uploading their data on things like, you know, is this lease going to renew or not? And what, how many inquiries have they been getting? And what apartment has been empty for longer than they expected, et cetera. Like, if they're all sharing all of this data with some central company and that central company is trying to model what is the revenue maximizing pricing for everybody, the temptation is for that company to look at is to start incorporating some game theory into the algorithm and saying, well, if everybody raised their rent by 15% this year, then you'd have to pay 15% more rent to live in this city, and that some fraction of people will leave. But a lot of people are not going to be completely priced out by that. They'll find a way to make it work. So if we coordinate our price increase, then we're good. Now, if you just got on a conference call with all of your landlord buddies and you happen to have every landlord in the city in the same room and you said, hey, let's all raise our prices 15%. We'll coordinate this. Nobody, you know, everybody do it. Nobody try to cheat and we'll win. That's straightforwardly illegal. And there was this fun point. It was actually citing a different paper. So there's a lawsuit that inspired this whole algorithmic collusion piece. It cited this paper on it that said, you need to do the Bob thought experiment, the Bob rule, which is, if you are describing some business and you say what the algorithm does, like we give the algorithm all of our data, the algorithm tells us what price to charge in order to maximize our money, and everybody in the industry uses the algorithm. Well, you change all those references to the algorithm to references to a guy named Bob. We tell Bob everything about our business. All of our competitors do too. Bob comes back to us and our competitors and tells us what price would maximize everybody's revenue. That would be collusion, right? So the question is, does Bob emerge as a property of these algorithms? And I think it's easier to argue if they are explicitly doing some kind of game theory thing where they are saying this price works conditional on somebody else not keeping their prices low, and also that we know they won't keep their prices low because they're using the same product, and so we can just tell them not to. So if the algorithm is literally doing that, then it is a problem for them. I'm not an antitrust lawyer, but I don't think that would be an incredibly hard case for the government to win. But if higher prices are an emergent property of smart revenue management, if it is just the case that, so the specific case, legal case in this case that prompted this whole post was that a group of casinos in Atlantic City are being sued for using a revenue optimizing piece of software that helps them raise their room rates, that since they started using this in like 2018, occupancy has gone down, but revenue per room has gone up because the people who do stay pay so much more. So they are using this product, and if they're coordinating, if the product is saying that we know that we can raise prices at this casino because this other casino is going to raise prices too, that becomes problematic. But if what they're actually saying is no, like if you look at the elasticity here, if you raise prices 10%, you get 5% fewer visitors. So you're actually net better off. You're just not charging people as much money as you could. That's just not an antitrust problem. Like doing that on your own is totally fine and legitimate and something businesses do all the time. It is in fact something that their employees do all the time. Every time someone asks for a raise, they're basically saying, if I ask for 5% more money, I think the odds of me losing this job and being forced to accept a worse job are worse than the odds that I just get the raise and get more money. So this is something everybody does if they're doing it on their own. You could have real fun with this and say that it is a plausibly deniable way for these businesses to unionize, that they're going to fight for $150 a night or whatever minimum wage there is to get one room in Atlantic City. But actually, I think this case, part of what it also illustrates is that it is really tough to figure out how you isolate the right economic variables to even demonstrate collusion, if the collusion is this emergent property. And the suit does try to advance this argument that everybody sort of knew it was collusion. They were all hanging out together and all trying to coordinate. But it honestly just describes a business where there are conferences and where software providers in that industry sponsor the conferences and try to throw lavish parties to sell their product. Could look like a big conspiracy thing, but if that is a conspiracy, then every industry is just this ongoing conspiracy and doesn't prove especially much about this single one. But the other thing that complicates this, the analysis with respect to casino hotels in particular, so it's to take a step back. If you're doing antitrust stuff, defining the market is really important because you can define some markets really, really broadly. So you could say like, this company has, 90% share in desktop operating systems. On the other hand, an operating system is a tool for interacting with data. So if you consider the fact that everybody can afford a pencil and paper, really, it doesn't have a monopoly at all. People just like the product more and they opt into that. And they could just do the numbers by hand and write stuff down instead of using Windows. So you want to define your market narrowly enough that the companies you're talking about dominate that market. And in this case, they define the market as casino hotels. They did point out that the Federal Reserve does actually track price levels. They track a producer price index for casino hotels and for hotels excluding casino hotels. If you look at those numbers, casino hotels have actually done better. They've raised prices more over the period in reference. But the hotel portion of the casino hotel is not the main business that these companies are in. It's a very badly run casino if the casino doesn't make money, but they make money on things like room service and people staying at their hotel. Like it's an ancillary thing, but it's a thing where you actually usually would want the price, you'd want to subsidize those hotels. You'd want to make the hotel so cheap that people are flying into Atlanta, they're going to Atlantic City as a cheap destination for a vacation, and then they happen to be walking through a casino, they see the slot machine, they play the slot machine, and suddenly your $100 room night, $100 a room fee is actually like $300 because the other $200 comes from money you lose playing negative expected value games at the casino. So it is actually not completely obvious to me that these companies would want their room rates to be lower. In fact, I think the meta conspiracy theory is that the revenue management company has just gotten really good at getting the casino companies to think of the hotel casino as an independent business that should be run on a standalone basis, and that they're actually making the companies money in terms of higher room rates, but costing them money in terms of fewer gamblers at the tables. I don't know that is entirely true, but like it is really, really tough to evaluate cases where there is a product that is a complement to a different product that actually produces more revenue and that is really the driver of the business. So it may be the case that all of this stuff that this case talks about of occupancy went down, but room rates went up. Another explanation for this is just these are reasonably well-run companies. They do try to maximize their margins, and they just know that Atlantic City casinos are a business in secular decline. It's just not the best place to gamble in the United States. You can go to Vegas and have a more elaborate casino experience. And casinos do have this kind of network effect. And there will be a diff piece on this on the Las Vegas model of communitarian hypercapitalism, where Vegas is like this place that is literally devoted to just seeing amounts of money go up and down and seeing how much variance you can add to your net worth for fun. But it's also a place where all the big casino companies collaborate to make it a really good place to do that kind of thing. And you have stuff like the Sphere, where there is this positive externality of just, there's only one place to see a sphere right now, a sphere of that magnitude, and you pretty much have to be there to see it. So it does create this spillover effect. It does create more demand for tourism. The bundle of like different casinos at different price points, different entertainment venues, et cetera, that does mean that there are just a lot more excuses to go to Vegas. That the industry conference business, also a great excuse to go to Vegas. And all of this ends up meaning that these casino companies are sort of working on behalf of one another, but it's a positive sum. It's positive sum if you're fine with gambling. It's very, very negative sum for all of these companies to be giving each other positive externalities when the positive externality takes the form of someone gambling money they really shouldn't be gambling and losing it all. So going back to Atlantic City, it is just possible that these companies are gracefully managing a decline. So going back to your point on the life cycle of business, when businesses reach the point where they should self-liquidate slowly, they often have a lot of pricing power because a lot of their customers have left, but the customers who are sticking around have some reason they haven't left yet. And if they are still willing to stick around as the product gets relatively worse compared to its nearest competitor, maybe it's force of habit, maybe it's sentiment, maybe they just don't know better, maybe they do in fact prefer the Atlantic City experience to the Vegas experience, whatever it is, you probably do have room to get them to pay more. And it may be that the casinos are doing the best with a fairly poor hand that they've been dealt, and that doing their best does mean raising prices. But that does not mean that algorithmic collusion doesn't exist and that it's not an issue that we should think about. And I think of it more in terms of consistency than, you know, is the absolute level of antitrust enforcement too high or too low, is that we really don't want a case where there is something that is, it's exactly the same substance and there's one way to get away with it and one way where it's totally illegal, especially if the way to get away with it also ends up creating some high margin software business, because then you're basically creating this bounty program where you want people to look at an industry where the big thing wrong with this industry is that there isn't a cartel that's just setting really high prices, and for them to just create a SaaS product that essentially embodies that cartelization and then make a bunch of money with it. Like that's just not a great thing for the economy, not a great thing for consumers, not the best thing that software entrepreneurs could be working on. So I do think there is a case to pay attention to cases of actual algorithmic collusion and to deal with them. And what makes it especially tricky is that if someone does algorithmically collude and that is their intention, they're actually a lot easier to catch because they will say something in some email that they know that indicates they know what's up on this. It will be discoverable. It will read very badly in a courtroom, and it will be apparent that they were trying to create a cartel. But if it happens accidentally, if it's just an emergent property of a sufficiently smart pricing algorithm, that algorithm takes into account the fact that other companies are using the same algorithm and figures out, okay, conditional on that, what's the really good equilibrium for our customers? And we just don't have consumer welfare as an input into our model. Well, in that case, there's no paper trail saying, hey, we're all going to get together and jack up prices. The paper trail is just, hey, this software product helps us price things better and it works for us. And the paper trail may even include things like, I hope our competitors don't hear about this because it's really good for us and I like being better than our competitors. And the people doing this think of themselves as just doing normal, prudent business things. They think of themselves as finding a good service provider who offers good value for their money and using that and running their company well. You can't catch them. It's harder to catch them, and they don't think they're criminals. And so they won't stop. The criminals may decide, hey, we made a lot of money doing this, but really, you know, every year we get more likely to get caught and I have enough vacation homes to be satisfied. So just not worth, the juice is no longer worth the squeeze. But if you don't feel like you did anything wrong and you don't feel like there is such a thing as getting caught, then you just keep going. And so it just keeps getting worse. So I actually don't know if technically, and this would be, you know, a fun game theory paper for someone to write, like, can those game theoretic strategies emerge organically from a model that does not actually include them? Or is it really only possible if your algorithmic pricing explicitly takes into account that someone else is using a pricing algorithm and that you know what that algorithm is? And so then there's this whole continuum of such things. Like sometimes airlines on their earnings calls, they will say things like, we are going to defend our share at this particular hub. We will not be underpriced by low-cost carriers, et cetera. This is something that United would sometimes say. And that is, like, that can be true of their business, but their intention in saying that could also be that they are carving up the market, that they're saying that Denver is United territory, and that if Spirit wants to expand, they should expand somewhere else, and that maybe Spirit shouldn't expand at all. which I think in retrospect was kind of right. So it could be this case where they coordinated and that on those earnings calls, everyone, you know, every airline executive is basically saying, here's the place where you shouldn't expand and here's where you should expand. And as you narrow down the places where it's prudent to expand, suddenly airline capacity is growing at less than GDP, which tends to be good for airline prices, for air ticket prices, instead of growing at more than GDP, which is when everyone in airlines, you know, remembers that airlines are a really bad business. So yeah, I think that kind of like antitrust stuff, it's always a moving target. I think a lot of these laws were written at a time where when there was just more of a business and financial elite, and there was like high trust within the elite, but the political system was fairly corrupt. And there was also just people had fewer moral qualms about things like price fixing. So you have a lot of these rules that basically assume that these people who were all in skull and bones together are going to periodically meet on someone's yacht, and they're going to pass out cigars and brandy and decide who gets what level of market share in the steel industry. But the laws are really not written for a case where people are running the math and using complicated machine learning models whose workings are opaque even to the people who created them. And it spits out some number. If you follow its recommendations, you tend to get better revenue. And then it turns out that what they're doing is actually tantamount to the yachts and brandy scenario from a century ago.
Is a good place to close on. Be mindful of time. Bern, another amazing discussion, and until next week.
Thank you. Yeah, this one was particularly fun. I liked it. All right, let's do it next week. Perfect. Later.
Thanks for listening to The Riff. Please go follow and subscribe. Give us 5 stars. And check out Bern's excellent newsletter, The Diff, if you haven't already.